Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Racing Lives. My name's Aurélie Donzelot, and in this podcast, I use motorsport as an excuse to chat to some of the most inspiring women I know. Each week brings a different guest, and we discuss everything, from career beginnings to what it's truly like to be involved in one of the fastest sports in the world. My guest today needs no introduction, which would make this podcast opening rather strange, so we'll proceed regardless. If you've worked or researched motorsport with any interest in media relations, then you will have heard of this pretty amazing lady. She held the role of team press officer for Williams F1 for 12 years, during which they secured no less than six Constructors' Championships and has been asked back no less than four times over the years. She's worked in communication roles for A1GP, BMW Motorsport, Sauber F1, many F1 circuits around the world, racing drivers, including the touring car champion Andy Priyo, and more recently joined W Series when it launched. She has mentored countless aspiring motorsport PRs, including myself over the years, and is one of the most knowledgeable, supportive, and perhaps most importantly fun person I've had the pleasure to work alongside. Can you tell I'm a huge fan yet? I would love to introduce my guest today as legendary, but I know she's not going to let me. So I shall simply say that she's known and loved universally throughout motorsport. My guest today is Anne Bradshaw.
What a load of baloney. What a load of baloney. Somebody's done a great PR job on you on my behalf, and I think I should employ them. If they can do that sort of PR on myself, they deserve a job in this sport.
Well, no one's done a PR. I think it's a group illusion. Then you've managed to hoodwink a whole load of us.
You can con people. It's true for 50 years.
I was going to say the consistency is pretty impressive.
Got to keep on message. You know it. The PR, don't change your message.
So would you say you got away with it then?
I totally got away with it.
If you'll allow me, I'd love to start at the beginning and ask you a very simple question, which probably has a very complicated answer, which is, when and where did your racing life begin?
Right, my racing life began at the British Racing and Sports Car Club, based in Chiswick, in 1971. And that's my first job in motorsport. I'd been a journalist up to then. And I, through a friend, got offered a job there, working for a lovely man called Nick Sarrett, who was the boss of the whole organisation. And we ran races. We had centres around the country, but I was in the headquarters and we ran races at Brands Hatch. So that's where I started organising. I went from being a journalist to being a race organiser.
And were you already a fan of motorsport at the time?
Oh, total. I mean, it's a family thing. You know, you get families, some families are football, some are cricket, you know, boxing, that sort of thing. It was a family, particularly my brother. I mean, my parents loved the sport, but particularly my brother, who used to do a bit of rallying. I mean, not professional or anything, but you know, he used to do some club rallyings. And a little girl, we were dragged along to races. I come from a farming family, and all my friends had ponies. You know, they were the pony club people. I was terrified of horses, but on top of that, my brother threatened me that if I showed any interest in horses, it would do no good. So from a kid, I mean, my parents used to go and marshal on rallies when my brother was taking part, and I was on the back seat in my sort of cot sort of thing. So yeah, always been there, always a family thing.
Is that the part you mentioned, being in the back of the car whilst your parents are marshalling? Is that your earliest motorsport memory?
I was told about that because I actually was a little bit too young. I was sort of in the cradle. I'm trying to think of my earliest memory. Most likely going to Mallory Park with my brother and standing at the S's, at Lake S's, and watching bikes and cars rush around there. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it was perhaps when I was in really sort of my teens. I mean, we used to go there, used to go to Snetterden. I mean, I remember watching Jim Clark race a Lotus Cortina around Snetterden, things like that. So I'm really sure my age. But yeah, they were the sort of things I remember before even anything like the F1. But also, my father, because we lived near the A1, my father used to walk me down the road in January to watch the cars go by who were on their way to the Monte Carlo Rally. Because in those days, the Monte Carlo Rally had starting points all around the world, well, Europe perhaps, and the world was a bit, yeah. And they always just start in, I think it was Edinburgh. And so I used to stand at the bottom of the road. We only lived a couple of hundred yards up the road. And so I used to stand there with my father watching these cars go by on the way to going down to Dover to go down to France and do the rally. So, and then the REC rally used to run stages quite near where I live, a place called Fineshade, which is about 2 or 3 miles up the road here. And I used to go and watch the cars there. So yeah, they were sort of my earlier memories, not, you know, that was as a youngster.
Do you feel it was a given that you'd end up working in motorsport, or did it come and found you when you were trying to hide away from it?
It's a difficult one because obviously, I mean, when I was at school, I wanted to be an actress, as you can imagine. Yes. But my parents thought that was not sensible anyway. Then I really wanted to be a journalist, which I did become a journalist for a local newspaper. And it was one of those things. I had lots of friends who worked in the sport, doing various things. It was a very good friend, lived in the village, and he used to run the motorhome for Yardley BRM. And literally, one day he rang me and said, oh, my girlfriend, who has been to see her old boss, who runs race meetings, and he's desperate for somebody. And we thought about you, because we know that, you know, you're fed up with journalism, you're sort of looking for something else. And it literally was that. It was a phone call. Went down to Cheswick, met this lovely guy, got offered a job and started. So yeah, it wasn't that I was looking for it, but obviously the opportunity would have just been, I'd have jumped at it and I was given the opportunity.
That's brilliant. How long until we get to my favourite part, which is you working for Williams in their absolute heyday? And I actually feel bad saying that because I wish their heyday was still now. But
yeah,
it's that period which is legendary with all those wins and all those amazing drivers. How did you end up working for that team?
Well, I mean, obviously I worked for the BRSCC. Then I went back to journalism, to autosport. And I went back to rallying. I was assistant rallies editor there. And then I got offered a job at the REC, which was REC MSA in those days. It's just the MSA now, governing body, as their press head of press and PR. So I was running the press office for the British Grand Prix and REC Rally and Kart Grand Prix and the London and Brighton Veteran Run. And then I got approached by a company called CSS. There's a guy called Andrew Marriott, Barry Gill, who I knew well, who ran. I knew them because they did PR for the likes of Marlborough and JPS. So we were working beside each other when I ran the British Grand Prix press office, because they were looking after the sponsor. And then they approached me and said, look, you know, we've got this client called Canon. They've signed a deal to go and sponsor Williams, and they want somebody to go and work to be the press officer for them and work alongside the team. And that's how it started in 85. So yeah, I took that job. And then, yeah, so I worked through this agency, but my only job was Williams, because we were also their sponsorship finders. And I stayed there, and it was the end of 93 that actually Canon finished with them. Rossman started. Obviously, I was working for the team, for the agency. So my contract said, you can't go and work for a client.
Yeah.
But they were on such good terms when they had a word with Frank, and who wanted me to work for him, and just said, oh, no problem. And they let me go directly and work for Williams. So that's how it I then went for the team, but up to then I was working for them, but I working for them at, from through an agency.
Which is often the way, actually, most of us end up starting motorsport through an agency, which is pretty good experience, I think.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a great... Tony Jardine worked there. I had some great fun. I did a year going around the world with him, which was perhaps the most traumatic time of my life because he was just so naughty and so funny.
This goes into the stories that you're not allowed to tell on, isn't it? You warned me about that.
I can tell you this one. He was so naughty. French Grand Prix, Fiona Miller, who's with WEC, and myself and Tony, we all worked. Tony was doing JPS, I was doing Canon, Fiona was looking after sponsors, Mobil, with Williams. And they booked us into this, well, apartment, they call it. You know, it was an apartment that was supposed to sleep six in Bandol, but basically it was a room with a little compartment. And Tony was so badly behaved. Fiona and myself would sort of try and just go to sleep in the evening, and there'd be Tony running around wearing a... I always remember him deciding to put a sheet on like Gandhi's nappy and impersonating him. Then we'd walk to the fridge, open the fridge door to get a drink, which is most like a bottle of Provence Rosé, and drop his nappy and things like that. It was hilarious, but it was great fun those days.
Oh, that's absolutely brilliant. Well, we often say that the good days were those days, and we're having to be a little bit more well behaved nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. The things we used to get up to, and the parties we used to have, and I remember there was always my birthday around that time, because my birthday's in July, and parties we used to have around, you know, in Bandol, in all those little seaside resorts that along the coast, Cassis. We used to sometimes stay in Cassis. And, you know, I remember every so often we'd be around this lovely hotel in Cassis, and we'd be around the swimming pool drinking and making noise, and I'd get somebody nice like Joe Ramirez from McLaren come and tell us to shut up and go to bed and things like that. But, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Being an international incident these days.
My birthday's always around the Monaco Grand Prix. In the last few years, I've had to be quite tame, unfortunately. But yeah, there's definitely some yacht-related parties that I look fondly back on.
Yeah.
Well, the purpose of the people that might be listening, I mean, the likelihood is all our mates are going to listen. But for anyone that's listening that actually doesn't work in motorsport, what would you say is the biggest misconception about the jobs that you've held?
Glamorous. Yeah, people say, oh, it must be so glamorous. You know, they think all we do is wander around, sit in motorhomes, chit-chat with drivers, and they actually forget that we have to do an awful lot of work. We have to, well, I suppose the best way is we have to control drivers, which is never easy.
Yeah.
Because we're in charge of a brand, which is a team we're working for, and we're in charge of making sure that we get the right story over, the right image and that. And on top of that, you've got a driver who isn't always happy, so you've got to look after, you've got to make sure unhappy drivers, it doesn't get out there. You've also got to make sure that you keep honest with the press and not try and bullshit them and that sort of thing. And you know, you've just got to work away. There's a lot of writing to be done, there's a lot of organizing, there's a lot of scheduling, you know, with the various things, and you've not just got two drivers, then you've also got a team principal, you've got a chief engineer, chief designer, and you've got to make sure that you look after all of them, that when the media want stories, they get the right stories, because as I say, if we don't look after the media, we don't have a job. And so yeah, it's not quite that glamour, especially in some stressful times. Let's be honest, we all know if you're winning, it's wonderful, but if you're not winning, or if you're having, you know, if something happens, then it really is quite daunting sometimes, because you've got to tread a very tight line between what you tell the media and looking after, you know, the best way to defend the team.
Yeah, and more often than not, is doing that whilst trying to be as truthful, as honest, as fair as possible. And when you've got seven different identities that you're trying to keep happy, it's not actually a job. We're very good at juggling, I think.
Yes, I think that's a very, very good way of describing it. Yeah, because you do, and our job, we are the forward facing people, but behind the cameras. So our job is to keep well out of the way of the cameras, but to influence what comes out in the papers and the TV and the radio. So it's difficult because you have to make sure that you're a bit of a magician, that you have to sort of say, well, here you are, there's something, and it's not very nice, but I'm going to wave my magic wand and it's going to come out right for us. So, yeah.
I like that. Magician is a very, very good way of putting it. And it makes it sound great. So I'll totally love that one.
We are great. As somebody once said to me many years ago, one of my favourite people in the sport, if it was easy, women would do it.
Oh! Oh, if only they knew. What about, I always find that motorsport being so competitive, we might not be the competitors ourselves, but I actually end up feeding on that competition. And I find myself being competitive with what I do. We often joke about who gets the first, you know, the first press release out after.
Totally.
How do you live that? Do you find yourself being very competitive? Are you competitive anyway?
I'm competitive in my job.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as you say, getting the press release, I'm back in the old days, she says, before of all the internet stuff, of course, we had a photocopier and we'd write the press release and then rush around the press office giving it to every journalist in whatever language they wanted. And I was so annoyed if I was not first, you know, or definitely even more annoyed if I was last. But luckily there was one guy who was always last, so we always knew there's no worry about that. He was always going to be last. But his was the most beautiful. It was the best written press release. It was amazing. But, yeah, at a cost.
He was last.
But you are competitive. You know, let's be honest, say, when you see an article that you've worked on placing and it gets in a national magazine, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, sort of the report on a Monday morning in the national papers or something. I'm talking about, you know, if you work on somebody and you see you get Vogue or you get Newsweek or you get Forbes or one of those, and you see an article or hear the Sunday Times, those sort of things, that's a great feeling of satisfaction, and you think, oh good, I got that one. You are competitive because you want that to be about your team. If they've got the space, you want the space to be your story, your team's story.
Definitely. Also, when you've worked on a really, really great feature and you've collaborated, you've put, you know, you might have pulled a specific car to go with it, a specific driver, who knows? You've put all that blood, sweat, and tears, and it comes out and it's just in a beautiful page. You might even get the cover. Dream.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And a front cover.
Oh.
I did get a Sunday Times front cover, not in F1, but in sports cars, and that was my favorite. But my even Autosport said, "What a coup to get the front cover of the Sunday Times magazine." That was my that's I still talk about that today. I'm you know that happened back in the mid 90s. I'm still living off it.
Too bloody right. That's amazing. And actually, that kind of leads on to my next question, which I wanted to know: how do you define success for yourself?
Well, success for myself is making sure that whoever I'm working with, whether it's a team such as Williams, whether it was when the days of BMW, whether it's when I'm working with Andy Prio, I make sure that, you know, that there's a, you know, positive articles and truthful articles, and you know, I perhaps help journalists find something that they wouldn't normally, you know, that they find a different angle. And I think that's part of what we need to do is rather than say, oh yeah, we've just won this race or that race, just find something a little bit behind the scenes.
That thing that's gone unknown but actually was key to that weekend, or actually just a lovely story, something really nice that's happening that no one knows about. I love finding those. And it's almost always the human element, of course.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, at the moment, the human element that's coming out of Formula One, you know, with the ventilator project, with people going back, like, you know, Williams, our lovely Sue, our occupational health lady, going back to to nursing after 20 years. Oh. We've got guys out there doing great things, delivering to you know, people who are in lockdown, or, you know, they're people who really could become very ill. Those sort of things, I think, are lovely, you know, as I say. And over a weekend, you can come across, okay, it's not quite as emotive as at the moment, but you've come across somebody who does something, or, you know, there's some little bit that they've got in there. And it's just nice.
I've never been prouder of my sport than when I saw how quickly we took on ventilator-related projects or anything to do with what's going on at the moment. And we put all the innovation, all the speed that we know how to use to such important use.
Yeah, it was lovely. It was great. It was great. I used to be on calls every morning at 8 o'clock and just hearing the guys and what they were doing. And
it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Given actually your wide rostrum of clients, and you've had some clients forever. I mean, Andy Prio, how long have you worked with him?
Since, 2000? Well, I got to know him. Yeah, I met him in 2002. It's 2003, I think, now I've been working with him.
Yeah, not a small stint.
No, he's needy. He's needy. No, I love that family. I mean, obviously, I saw the children grow up, the most delightful children. I always said, never wanted children, but if I had to have them, if they were like Seb and Danielle Prio, I wouldn't mind. But and Joe and the family and his dad, and they're just the nicest people.
It's lovely that you're speaking about his family, because I wanted to ask you exactly that. How have you balanced your family and friends' expectation with the work that you have to do, because it takes us away so much? How do you actually balance your work and your life?
It's difficult. I mean, I've missed a lot of family events, weddings, funerals, you know, those sort of things. You have. And I think the trouble is, you just, you know, when you get into this life, you have to accept that it's not something you do 9 to 5 and you're home in the evening and you can say, oh, well, I need a day off to go and do this, or my cousin's getting married and so-and-so. You have to decide whether the job will come first, and it has to. And I feel, you know, I know a lot of people, obviously, it's easier these days, because when I first started, I was the press officer, and that was me. I was the press officer. I didn't have a social media person. I didn't have anybody else. So if I had something else that weekend, tough. And then now, you know, let's be honest, say most press officers will do a bit of a rota. So you can. But yeah, I mean, it was a shame, but there you go. And I had a job to do. I love my job. And if I, you know, had to miss out on some things because I was the other side of the world, or because, you know, that had to happen. And, you know, that's life. And my family understand. I mean, I'm being a motorsport family, they appreciated it. And so it's I mean, a lot of friends, obviously, you end up, your friends are your motorsport friends. I have got some friends, you know, sort of perhaps my best friend out of the sport. We used to share a flat, and she was a fabric designer for Sanderson's, and she always used to laugh about what I was up to. And we see each other, we talk about once a month, and we see each other whenever we can. But most of my other friends are motorsport friends. They're because they understand that's what you do. Let's be honest, you can socialize together because you're away together. So it's easier that way.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And don't you find going through the traveling experience and actually working such long hours alongside each other, if not together, that breaks down a lot of barriers? You actually end up with some people that know you really well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Because you're spending hours in airports together. You could be on buses or trains, or, you know, you just standing in F1 TV pens, holding a dictaphone machine and standing next door to and chattering away, and hoping that the TV camera doesn't catch you chattering and laughing, which it invariably does, because it's not the one in front of you, it's the one behind you catches, but things like that. But and that's nice, because you've got a lot in common, haven't you? You invariably talk about work, but then our work is our life. It's not, we don't do work and life. There's no, oh, your work's there and your life's there in what work we do, because it all blurs into one.
It's completely meshed, isn't it? You can't, it takes too long anyway. So if we were trying to segment the two, you'd get no time.
No.
Can you identify a proudest moment so far And did you get a chance to celebrate it?
Oh, Damon winning the World Championship, without doubt. Yes, and yes, we did get time to celebrate it. It was amazing. It was surreal. And actually, it's funny because it was actually even nicer, the fact that it happened in Japan, though we were a long way from home. It meant that time-wise, the stuff we did worked. And I mean, I remember, we did all the press conferences and all that sort of thing. And then the party started. But I'd still got a press release to write. I'd still got people queuing up in the UK, like the David Frost programme. Sky and those sort of people, they were queuing up for when they came on air for the breakfast programmes to interview Damon. The problem was, we'd all had some of us had a few drinks by that point. And we didn't have, nice motorhomes and areas and terraces. We had one room, which was where I was writing, the caterers were cooking, the engineers were working, and Frank was on his frame with his physios, doing his stuff. And we were doing that all in one room, with hell breaking loose, with David Coulthard running in and covered in salad dressing, and Michael Schumacher coming in with a bucket of water and things like that. And you think, well, this is crazy. And then, then when all that all over, and you went to the log cabin that used to be at Suzuka, and we were all in this big karaoke cabin with Michael and Dame and a whole gang of us. And then on the plane, the train the next day up to Tokyo to do lots more interviews. We did CNN. We went and did it from the Reuters offices. And then we went off with a pile of journalists, all the national guys who'd come with us, like the Mail and the Express and the Times and the Telegraph, and went off to Roppongi and went to the Cavern Club. And there was Damon on the stage singing Drive My Car with the lookalike Japanese Beatle band, things like that.
I'm having to laugh silently.
It was when Michael Schumacher rushed through the door with this bucket of water and stood in front of Frank, and you could see he was thinking, should I throw this bucket of water over Frank or not? And you could see it, and then at which point he looked round, turned around and ran out again. DC then proceeded to explain to Frank why he was right to sack him, because he was useless. And it was hilarious. It was just such a fun thing. Everybody was there. Was the guy who used to run the motorhome for Bernie and for Rothman, was a guy called Karl-Heinz Zimmermann, was upstairs giving everybody snaps. And there was Gerhard Berger was cutting the legs off the jeans of the local Japanese ladies who were getting terribly excited. It was it's one of those things. It was good, clean fun.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And if I may, I'd like to ask you about the flip side, which is, have you had to experience some low points? And I hope, you know, have you recovered? How did you recover?
Well, yeah, May 1st, 94, you know, you don't recover because, you know, you're sad and something that you love has suddenly become very emotional and very sad. You have to go on to autopilot. I mean, I've had other drivers injured. I mean, Nigel Mansell in Suzuka, and also when he went through six layers of catch fencing in Paul Ricard. You know, he was prone to doing those sort of things, bless him. But yeah, nothing, you know, and you just have to go on autopilot. You have to become professional. I mean, you have so many people to think about, not just yourself, because you have obviously you have the driver, you have his family, obviously the media have a story. And also the most important thing that people tend to forget, you have a team there who've been working on that car, and those guys are wondering if they've done something wrong.
Yeah.
So, you know, people tend to forget that human side of it. You know, obviously it's devastating for the family. You've lost somebody you love, but, you know, this engineer, is it mechanic, you know, the guy put the car together, and obviously people like Patrick Head and Adrian Newey, who designed the car, and Frank, who it was his dream to get Ayrton in the car, those sort of things. You just have to, yeah, you know, and you just have to go on to do everything by remote and just make sure everything's done professionally, and you don't put anything out that can be misconstrued. But you actually look after those people and make sure that they all know where they stand, make sure that the media get what they want, but they don't intrude into a private grief and things like that. So it's, yeah, there's so many elements to that, and so many people who were amazing, who helped us out, and, you know, did little things like Tony Dodgins, bless him. I ended up, I wasn't due to fly home till the next day. I ended up at 11 o'clock at night in Gatwick. And my car was at home in Ealing, and the guy just right driving you home and totally out of the way. And he drove for about 3 hours out of the way to drop me off home. And, you know, little things like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, and also the people at the airport knew that we had problems and said, look, you know, they messaged us on the plane, anything we could do, and we got them they took Damon and Geordie out the back door and put barriers up, made sure that, you know, and then let me out early to go and talk to the media. So, you know, a lot of people were very mindful of the sort of thing. There was my friend Jane Gorard, we worked together there. She was with me as well. So we just, you know, we were able to make, you know, just do our job, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. And, you know, Frank, obviously, he was very strong. I mean, yeah, he'd been through it before, hadn't he? Obviously, back in the old days with Piers Courage, but he was very, very good. And he just looked at us and said, if you think you're going to cry, put your sunglasses on. You know, that was the best advice I had. And, you know, all sorts of Louise Goodman, she knew we got a problem, so she drove us to the airport and things like that. Yeah, all those people, there were, you know, it became a community. Nobody was trying to score points or say, oh, you know, they were just all trying to help us, which was phenomenal. But it was tough. It was, and it didn't stop there, because the whole week then stories were coming out, and we'd got a whole pile of people coming to the factory. Very respectful, a lot of Brazilians who I'm still in touch with to this day, leaving, they bring us flowers, bring us cakes, leave scarves and flags, and obviously also the breakfast programmes wanted interviews. I remember sitting on my sofa at about 6 in the morning with them in my with my flat and things like that. It went on and on, and it went on for weeks and months, because obviously that was the low, and, you know, Ayrton was doing what he loved doing. He was a racing driver, And nobody should die for anything they love, but that you know the risks in certain sports, in certain things you do, you have to know and accept the risks, and that's part of accepting what you do and loving what you do.
And it's the same for us. We know that when we show up for work, that's one of the risks that we might have to deal with.
Yeah, and we all have a crisis plan, and we all make sure we know what to do, and don't say this and don't say that, and this person can talk. And we've all got that document, which we hope we'll never use, but we have it, and that's part of we have to make sure we've got it.
I really wish I wouldn't be able to relate so well to what you've just been saying, but unfortunately, I have, and we do recently, and I cannot wait for the day where the time that span from the last one is, you know, too long for us to have to remember it.
Yeah,
we still have the document.
Well, that's right, but you had a family to think about, and they needed you to be professional.
Yeah,
they needed you to sort of take the hands and make sure that they were looked after, they were respected, and that's important. Why we do what we do, we have to be ready for the good as the bad, and they will look to you, and it's a testament to how that played out, because it was desperately sad, but it was handled in a very respectful way.
I love the fact that you referenced community. I speak about motorsport a lot as if it's a family. Once you're there, the network that you have available to you, and the way we actually all work together within the paddock, because it's not just team, is it? It's all the press officers know each other and work together, all the communal support, the FIA, everything. It's a massive circus, but it's also a massive family.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's over the years, some of the great times I've had just with other press officers, other PR people, and just all sitting down, bitching about people, or saying, well, that can't be.
Letting off steam.
just bitching between ourselves, God, they did annoy me when he asked that sort of thing.
I like to compare notes. It makes me feel better.
yes, you think, I'm not the only person who that person annoyed this week.
What, actually, whilst we're talking about one of the things I love about motorsport, what do you love the most about this crazy industry that we work in?
Oh, gosh. I'm just a fan. I think that, I'm sad. I'm so missing it. I'm watching esports races. Oh, God. Everybody who knows me in esports. We're not good bedfellows. But I was there on Sunday watching Monaco, and I was getting excited, and Sam kept saying, it's not real, it's not real. I said, no, but we're leading. It's just been a thing that I've always enjoyed. I'm a fan of the sport. I love all motorsports, two and four. I mean, I consider myself, like you said, they're motorsport, not an F1 person. I'm a motorsport person. And when I was young, my parents, about 2 miles up the road, there was a little scrambling course in the field. I used to get on a bike and go in there on the Sunday, just watch that. And I like the competitiveness. I like what people get up to. I like their passion. And it inspires me. And that's what I love about it, because you're seeing people passionate about what they do, doing it often at their own detriment because they're spending all the money on it, but it's something I enjoy, and I just love what they're doing. And I think I like it, whether it's Formula One, whether it's touring cars, sports cars, you name it, even at the moment now esports.
Well, it's still competitive. There's still a massive competitive element.
I love how they've all taken to it. I mean, it being good at those esports isn't just sitting there, getting there, twitching it on. These guys like George and Charles, they are practicing.
They're spending hours.
And you feel somebody who is a very good driver but doesn't quite get it, or hasn't got the time, or hasn't just, it just isn't their thing. And you think, people are going to be watching and saying, oh, he's useless. But people aren't taking into consideration this is a very different thing that they're doing now. And I feel a bit sorry for them, but it's keeping us going, isn't it?
You referenced it, and actually really wanted to ask you, in your career, how have you kept things fresh and kept yourself motivated, keep learning, keep growing, when by definition, the sport that we do, any motorsport, is actually quite repetitive over a week or over a year? You know, you've still got the season, it's quite well structured. So how do you keep things fresh for yourself, and how do you keep learning?
Well, I mean, I've kept myself obviously fresh for myself because I've done lots of different things. I'm not just an F1. I had three amazing years covering sports car racing, the IMSA Championship in America, which I loved. I absolutely loved, and I'd go back there tomorrow. I love it. I work with Andy Prio, so follow his stuff. No 2 years are the same. So I don't find, you know, different drivers and different cars. But I do like to keep, like W Series. I mean, that to me was just amazing, just doing something so different. Yeah. I love that. That was such fun last year. And again, you know, it's different. The people, obviously a lot of them, people like Matt Bishop and those sort of people who I worked alongside. I didn't work with them as such, but I knew them as journalists or fellow PR people. And it was just lovely to do something different. And I just found the whole thing so refreshing. I mean, I know, when it first came out, I thought, do we need just an all-women? But I was soon a convert. And it was just so nice to do something very different, have a lot of fun. I mean, we did have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot of fun.
It looks like a lot of fun.
In and out of the car. Saturday nights was a lot of fun. And the great drivers, they were so lovely. I mean, you know, as I say, you've got so many great from around the world. I mean, it's you know, I don't want to pick one out. Obviously, you know, you get closer to some others, but they just made it a great championship. And I think that's my thing. And let's say even, you know, like with F1, though, I've been in and out of it a few years doing things, I still like to look, because it doesn't stand still. You know, I'm not an engineer, and I don't pretend to know all those things, but it's still, I find it fascinating. You know, like when we arrived in Barcelona and Mercedes had come up with something new, I thought, and everyone's getting excited, that is brilliant. That's what we should be doing. You know, that if we're at the top of our sport, you can't just turn up with the same old. And I love the fact that somebody, some bright spark who should be Einstein, sitting there in Brackley, coming up with that. I thought, no, that just keeps me entertained, excited, and yeah. And I think the sport doesn't stagnate. It never does. I mean, I know people complain, oh, well, it's always Mercedes this and it's boring this. They did that with Williams. We were winning all the time. But so what? You know, we did the best job. And let's say somebody does a good job and you say, well done. Somebody does a bad job, you say, well, learn from the person who's doing the good job and do better. And to me, that's whatever you're doing in life. And I like that. And you look at some of the teams that have had gone through bad times and then suddenly back up there. It's because they've done a good job, and it's good to see that. And I like that. That's what I like. The world I live in, I like seeing that. I don't like seeing people just the same day in, day out. Yeah.
And actually, I find, fine, if Mercedes keeps on winning, of course we'll moan about it because we want to be winning.
Yeah.
We do all support each other, and we do actually recognise that, yeah, they are the best right now, and it's on our job to beat them. It's not on them to bring their standard down or on us to bitch about them. It's for us to work harder and be more clever and beat them.
Yeah. I mean, back in the days when we were up the top there, Frank always used to say, there's no such thing as total domination. Somebody will overtake you, because while you're trying to stay there, they don't have that pressure, and they're looking every which way to try and overtake you. And it happened with Williams, it happened with Ferrari, it happened with Red Bull. You know, it'll happen. It'll happen again, and somebody will come up, and there you go. And that's what's great.
What about on the flip side and stress? How do you handle stress? Do you even get stressed?
Don't do stress. yeah, I mean, you can worry about things, and you know, I was thinking, oh God, that really, it goes over in my brain, but I don't need to stress me out, because then I'm not clear minded enough to work out how I'm going to cope with it, and it's, I mean, yeah, I'd say I worry about doing it the right way, but stress, yeah, I feel for people who stress, because I know a lot of people who stress, and they stress over much more important things than my little worries, you know, about how I'm going to deal with a journalist who I know is going to come and ask difficult questions, and you worry about how you're going to deal with it. But compared to people who have to make life and death decisions, you know, if they're in the National Health, like these people at the moment who are looking after people who are desperately ill, that stress, you know, because you know it's going to be there the next day, and you don't know how you can deal with it. With me, a journalist is difficult. Well, so be it. You know, we'll have forgotten. There'll be something else coming. They can write about something else the next time. So,
no big deal.
No big deal. No, it is at the time if I'm annoyed, but it's no big deal.
This might make my next question redundant. I wanted to ask you, how do you relax? How do you switch off? But you might not need to.
Oh, well, I suppose, how do I switch off? Well, gardening. My two dogs. My gardening. Yeah. I got my two dogs. I got Elvis and Priscilla, my Pekingese. And they're just calming and lovely. And, yeah, gardening. Bottle of wine. Nice. Gin and tonic. I'm very lucky where I live. I live in a little village in the middle of the country, but very near to civilization, if I want civilization, and can get most things I want. I think that just having somewhere to come back to that you're happy that you are happy coming back to it. And just to come into an atmosphere where I actually can relax, and that's good. And every so often, you know, you think, oh, well, I'll sit down and watch a movie. I mean, and that relaxes me. I watched Top Gun for the 2000th time the other night. Just had to. It's Frank Williams' favorite movie, and I agree with him. And I said that, you know, I can, you know, things like that. And I'm not the person who will come in and watch box sets of Game of Thrones and anything like that, but every so often I'll just do that, or put some music on and just wander around and pick out weeds
and dance.
I'm not very good at I dance with my dustbin. Yes,
I wanted to ask you for your advice, but not necessarily for me. I wanted your advice because you've done this for a while. I think you've got it nailed. And for a lot of the people that are actually listening who come to us, I know you get a lot of people coming to you asking about working in motorsport. What advice would you give them?
The advice has changed a bit over the years, because in the old days, I'd say to them, well, like, for instance, if you join your car club, join your local car club, and see if you can, you know, get involved with them, because they all, you know, they used to all run race meetings, and you could perhaps write articles for their magazine, and then from that get to know people in the sport, and, you know, even help out with teams and that. So it was that was one thing I always used to recommend to people. Nowadays I say, well, make sure that, you know, if you want to do PR, yeah, you know, then if most people are going to college or university, make sure it is related to that, because there are lots of marketing PR based things that you can get involved with, a lot of courses, degrees, and that's always helpful. I mean, a few people I've come across recently have done that and have gone on to get really good jobs in the sport. There's a young girl who came and got in touch with us at W Series who just loved the sport. She was an older girl. She was in her 30s and done lots of things, but she'd gone back to university and done sort of marketing and PR and broadcasting, and she's now working for BBC Wales and got a brilliant job in the sport department there. And so I say, you know, do try and that sort of thing. Don't just look at Formula One, because there are obviously race circuits, there are sponsors, there are Formula 2, Formula 3 teams. Obviously, the money there isn't quite Formula 1 money, but spread your net. And yeah, sadly, you know, in the old days, you could contact Autosport and say, oh, I'm going so-and-so. Have you got anybody covering it? I'll cover it for you. And they'd take your article. it's not like that these days, sadly, because there aren't the magazines and things that have that sort of thing. But I mean, a lot of people who I worked with over the years, I mean, that they actually did that. You know, they actually would write in as a lovely Peter Fubister, who he was a civil servant in Scotland, and we met him on a rally, and he used to be he'd ring in every Monday with all the news from the Scottish rallying scene, and when I gave up my job there, I persuaded him to come and take it. But he'd already been doing stuff for us and writing articles. I know a lot of people now come in via agencies and you know, they'll go in those, but so there is, you know, there's that, because there are a lot of sponsors who are more proactive and want somebody doing PR, marketing, that sort of thing. But I still think that, you know, sort of trying to get in a little more on the ground floor, you then, if you're at the grassroots, you get to understand the sport. And I'm always disappointed when I come across people in a paddock who if I mention Andy Priaulx, wouldn't know I'm talking about, or, you know, sort of, yeah. Jason Plato, or, you know, like when I, in the States, you know, sort of I got Joey Hand and the sort of, who are amazing people, and Jonathan Edwards and those sort of things, but they don't know who I'm talking about because they're so fixated. And I always say, just look at other forms of the sport, because there are a lot of things out there. 2-4-wheels karting and that. There's so much out there that you could get involved in and then work your way up and be in the right place at the right time. And just, yeah, you know, you never know who you're going to meet.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I love the most. I did that. I went through, I mean, I used to have bets with some of the people that were racing in the younger categories, whether they would get to Formula One first or I would. Yeah. And I've made my way around. I've worked in touring car and everything. And yeah. What I love the most is that I can walk into any paddock, almost anywhere, and I'll know people.
Yeah.
And that doesn't come from just staying in one lane.
Yeah, I mean, when a lot of people, I'm sure you get it, people say, oh, how do I get into Formula One? And that's the thing. And I start off and say,
motorsport.
How do you get into motorsport? Don't categorize motorsport and Formula One as one of the, you know, it's not. And, you know, unless you're very lucky, you're not just going to walk into a job, because people like to know that you've probably been experienced. But look at the wider issue and look at other forms.
Definitely. What about advice that someone's given you that you've kept for yourself and you've used to this day?
Oh, that, don't take yourself too seriously.
Perfect advice.
Don't take yourself. And you can't, I mean, I walk into a Formula One paddock and I see a lot of people, really lovely people. Then I see people who think, because they've got a bit of plastic around the neck, that lets them into, you know, that, you know, who are the animals and who are the, you know, which side are the animals, and they think that makes them different or special. Yeah, don't take yourself to, you're doing a job you love, enjoy that, but don't strut around as though you've made it, because you haven't. You're just one little cog in a big wheel, and have fun, enjoy it. But the day you actually start taking yourself seriously, then you'll stop enjoying it, because you'll be too fixated on your own image.
You'll be too self-involved. You won't be looking around seeing everything that's awesome that's going on around you. That's a good one. I'm so glad you said that. Final question. I can't believe it. I could speak to you for hours. What are you most looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to? Obviously, I'm looking forward to racing starting when it can be safe and it's the right time. I'm looking forward to the unknown. I'm looking forward to the next team to come up. You know, I'm looking forward to just seeing which direction our sport is going to take, you know, who's going to come up through, you know. I'm looking forward to seeing who's going to be the next Lewis Hamilton. You know, I want to know who out of Verstappen, Albon, Russell, Leclerc, Norris, I want to know which one of those, I'm looking forward to finding out which one of those is going to become the next world champion. I'm looking forward I'm looking forward to seeing the new regs when they come out, you know, in 2022. I hope they, you know, I hope it's not 2025 or something. I'm looking forward to seeing how the teams will cope with a very big seismic change in the sport. And I'm just looking forward to enjoying more years following a sport that has kept me entertained for 50 and, you know, might keep me entertained for one or two more.
I hope not just one or two.
Well, no, I wish people would stop asking me when I'm going to retire. Because why would I retire when I'm enjoying myself? And, you know, people say, well, when are you going to retire? I say, well, why should I? You know, this isn't work. This is having fun. If this is work, then bring it on.
Wise words to end the interview on. And thank you so, so, so much for doing this. Thank you.
Pleasure. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And let's look forward to the time when we can sit face to face with a bottle of something between us and I can tell you some of the stories I couldn't tell you on live.
Neil, I'm bringing the rosé and it's going to be from the south of France.
Oh, can't wait. Can't wait.
That was the one and only Anne Bradshaw, everyone. And I cannot express how thankful I am to her for giving up her time and coming on here to have a chat. I'm also really, really looking forward to that glass of rosé one day soon. I'll never be able to tell the stories, but I know I'm going to giggle the whole time. If you'd like to know more about Anne, just type her full name, Anne Bradshaw, and then add F1 into your internet browser. That's it. That's how well known she is within our sport. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform. Tell your friends, post about it on social media. It all means so much, and I read every message and every mention. You can also get in touch directly, of course, if you'd like. That's via my Instagram account, which is Pandea, Pandea. Thanks very much for listening and speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.